Welcome to the Tim Hill Podcast. If you have the time, you can not only listen to the episodes, but you can also watch all the shows, and you'll find the links in the description below. Thank you. Welcome to Series 3 of the Tim Hill Podcast. In the last two series, I've told you about my life. I've met many interesting people along the way who have become my friends, and what they all have in common is they have fascinating stories of their own, which they are happy to share with you now. Thank you for listening. Welcome to the Tim Hill Podcast. In this episode, I'm going to have a chat with Will Doc Black. That's a bit of a conundrum, isn't it? Will Doc Black? Doc Black. Anyway. It'll all become obvious once we get into it. So, Doc, if you can tell me when or where you were born, if you could describe to me what it was like where you grew up, the schools you went to, and the education that you received. So you're on deck. How you doing, Will?
Doing well.
Good.
So I was born in Athens, Alabama. And my dad was a contractor. He used to work for like TVA and stuff. So we moved around quite a bit in my childhood. So even though I was born in Athens, Alabama, I did not grow up in Alabama. He worked on the outskirts of Detroit when I was younger, probably. So hard for me to remember my childhood. Probably till I was 15. I would say is most accurate. Environmentally, you know, of course, he was an up and coming contractor. My mom didn't have any kind of an education. And she had, you know, us two kids, my sister and myself. So we're on the, poorer side of things, I would say in that era. But dad did start to make some money. From there, and then we moved into Illinois, Chicago area. And there I went on to graduate high school. My schools were, I don't know, I'd say middle of the road, average schools. Yeah. Nothing, you know, too crazy good or crazy bad.
So what was your elementary school like?
Elementary, I feel like, was probably like the best time I ever had in school, to be honest. I remember it most vividly, and I pretty much hated from probably fifth grade on. Things got a little rougher, you know.
So what was the elementary school? Whereabouts was that? So you started off in Athens and then moved to Illinois, or Detroit?
It's funny. I could tell you like my teacher's name, Mrs. Walmer, I remember, but as far as what the school was, I'm not actually sure. which I know is like a bummer, but yeah, I don't know that I could tell you any school I went to. I can tell you where I went to technical school and things like that. But yeah, my early life is always a bit hazy for me. I had a rougher childhood. You know, I'm not sure that my mom was ever at a capacity to have children, and parent them properly. And, my father was was an abusive alcoholic. Mm-hmm. So it felt very, unstable, I guess. I know that now, obviously as a child, yeah. I didn't think of it that way at all. But you know, looking back and trying to remember, and it's like, yeah, I was very jumbled up. Another thing I do remember specifically is in high school, teachers would constantly ask me if I was okay, if my home life was okay, because I was just a struggling student, right? And I always hated that because they'd pull you out of class, they'd talk to you, and I'm like, hey, I just want to be left alone, you know, I want to get through this. And, you know, it's funny now because as an adult, I realized I had really great teachers, right? They knew something was amiss and they actually cared, you know.
Did you respond to that as a child, or you just sort of just fended them off and just
like I say, just wanted to get on.
I just wanted to get on with it. I didn't, you know, I always say, you know, when you don't know, you don't know. And, you know, a lot of people have atypical childhoods or things that are atypical in their life all the time. And they're really kind of unaware of it because it is normal to them, sadly, you know? So we just don't know any different. And it wasn't until way later in my life, well, until I went into an inpatient facility where I started to think, well, maybe I did have some childhood anomalies or things that just weren't exactly right.
So moving slightly on then, so you've got elementary school was a bit of a blur, shall we say. So into your high school, so you were kind of struggling through that.
Yeah, I played sports and things, but I was always just the skinny, you know, just to be honest, the skinny, greasy haired, quiet kid, you know, I just probably didn't have the best, hygiene, routines back then, for lack of either myself or just, you know, blame it on whatever you want, but it's just the way it was for me.
Boys tend to generally need a little bit of prod to solve. on the hygiene front at the best of times. Certainly when I grew up as a kid, it was bath night was the worst night in a week.
Really.
Back when I was growing up, it was a sort of Sunday night, you'd have a bath, and then Monday was sort of wash day.
I was probably close to that, and I probably shouldn't have been, you know. And I did. I played sports. I just was never good or strong at making friends or making human connections. And I struggled with that up until probably my 40s. And I'm only 42 now. So
so what sports were you playing?
Well, I played soccer. I loved soccer. I loved the track and field, and did some baseball as well. So I played basketball, but everybody was so much bigger and so much, taller. And I was always a small kid. And honestly, I probably could have made the team, right? I just wasn't going to play. And I knew that. And it just didn't seem worth it to me.
So that was a struggle just getting through high school then. So what happened when you left high school? Where did you go from there?
Well, from there, I went to a place called Hamilton Technical College, and I wanted to. I used to build computer. I had this fascination with computers because, you know, computers had just kind of come out, like the old 486 models and stuff like that, and it was just, it was so new. Everything was transforming so fast. It just felt like the avenue to go, right? So, my parents had left the state. I was still living in Illinois. My parents had packed up and moved back to Alabama, and I was living with a friend. I had a job at, Best Buy actually. And, it was supposed to be a seasonal temp job, but, turned out to be much, much more. I was promoted very fast and into a department supervisor at one point, and I was going to school and I would pack two lunches, you know, trying to get through school, trying to work this full-time job. I don't have any family support, but, you know, truth be told, I didn't really ever have family support anyway. So it wasn't like a big hole that was, you know, suddenly felt like a void, right? Because they were gone. It was nothing like that because wasn't used to it anyway. But it was just too much for me and too hard. I lacked the focus and I was a dumb kid on his own. So school felt less and less important. I kept that job and ran it for a long time. Then I had met my first wife there, who was 19 at the time. And I think I was 24. And at that point, I was trying to get more career aspirations and, you know, do better with my life. And I got a job at, I'm pretty sure it was Verizon Wireless. And then I wanted to transfer to Alabama because I thought, you know, maybe I should get closer to my family. So moved her and myself to Fort Payne, Alabama. I got a crappy little apartment, you know.
So?
Got a...
Go ahead. So just go back slightly. You was at the technical college doing engineering, but computer engineering, computer sciences?
Well, a lot of hands-on. Well, it was mostly like with like PCBs, like printed circuit boards, and it's, you know, Ohm's law, just all the electrical things down to a component level. I didn't graduate. I didn't end up graduating. Like I said, it was just too much, and I just let it go to the wayside. You know, I was just not the. I've never been good at school. It's just not my thing. I love to learn, but I think I'm just hard headed in the way that I just want to learn what I want to learn. You know, a lot of times it's like, well, you have to have, you know, these gen eds to go into this field. And it's like, yeah, I understand that, but I don't care about those gen eds and I'm never going to. So ultimately it changes my mindset to where, you know, when I say I want something, it's like, oh, well, you have to do this. And it's like, never mind, I don't want it. You know, I'm realistic about what I will and won't do, you know, because I'm very good at accomplishing goals. But like I said, I understand the value of when people say, I want this, like, do you really want it? Because I understand that about myself. And if there's stuff that I just hate, I'm not going to trudge through it a lot of the time.
So you moved back to Alabama with your wife at that time.
Yep. And then we divorced shortly after. She was 19. I was 24. Looking back, obviously, that was the only outcome that was probably going to happen for two people who made a really half-hearted commitment and didn't have financial stability, didn't have family stability, just didn't have any stability, you know.
So what did you do after you got divorced then?
I went, I kept working, and 9/11 had happened in there, somewhere in between. I mean, we were still married when 9/11 happened, and divorced shortly after. I went through all kinds of things with 9/11. You know, I knew I was going to join the service, and really get in there. It just felt bad to sit back and just watch it happen. You know what I mean? And you never knew how much or how little, you know, what did that mean for the future of America, or what did it mean for the future of our generations? You know, as somebody who's looking at having kids in the future, having a niece, you know, that whose life I was involved in. So I put a lot of thought into it and really came up with, well, I'm going to join the National Guard. And I obviously didn't do that. Then I wanted more. You know what I mean? I'm not so much into the half-hearted decisions, like, you know, fully commit on something. And then I wanted to be an Army Ranger. And, you know, I really weighed that out in my head. You know, combat and killing people and stuff, these are like things that you'll undoubtedly face in a career where, you know, 9/11 has just happened. And it's like, I wasn't necessarily avoidant of it. And I'm not a conscientious objector necessarily, but it just wasn't the best feeling for me. You know, I thought, you know, that's really heavy. And I think that's probably a job for someone else. You know what I mean? And then I found out about Navy Corpsmen. So I signed up to be a Navy Corpsman.
So you explain what a Navy Corpsman is.
So Navy Corpsman is a really unique thing through the Marine Corps. So the Marine Corps does not have its own medical staff. They've always used the Navy and the Navy Medical Corps, Navy Corpsmen. So Navy Corpsmen can be, you know, on ships and hospitals, or it can be just straight up attached to Marine Corps grunts, or even Marine Corps in the rear, or, you know, you're going to be embedded somewhere where, because there's always a medical need somewhere.
So let's just...
And I just...
So you signed up?
I just wanted to run... Yeah, I just wanted to run around with grunts and do medical stuff. That felt more at home to me as a naturally empathic person and humanitarian, you know. It felt right. And so I was all in, you know, signed up and joined.
So where did you do your training?
So I went to Great Lakes to do boot camp, and then which I believe at the time, and it may still be the only boot camp place left for the Navy. And from there, I just went like across the street to the Great Lakes Naval Hospital there. They have the Corps school. And did another 14 weeks in the medical portion.
So what was the initial training like? Was it like normal sort of infantry type Marine sort of?
Well,
so yes,
so
no,
I so to do,
feel, was it a little bit more?
So yeah, so when you go to like a so you've graduated boot camp, so you don't have the where it's all the you know, super uptight, fold this, do, you know, everything right. So it relaxes a little bit, but not like a ton. You don't necessarily have drill instructors, but you have instructors. And you do have freedoms, right? You can go out at night. It's just kind of like a job, right? You go to school and you get home, you can do your stuff, but you still have to clean your room. You still have to maintain uniform. So I have to report in when, you know, necessary, still have duty.
So just step back slightly, the initial training, how long did that last, the boot camp?
I had a 9-week boot camp.
So was it centered around sort of infantry work, or was it just drill and looking after yourself, or was it proper combat?
Yeah, a lot of it, because it's the Navy, you do a lot of like ship stuff and learn about ship life, right? Which would make sense for, you know, 99% of the Navy that would be true, right? You will be on a boat at some point. You know, we did have some arms training. We did the drill stuff. You know, I'd imagine most boot camps are pretty standard as far as that. Nothing too... Like, you know, just the specialty of the ship stuff as the only thing. You know, like I remember having a class about tying knots, which seems silly, but I mean, if you're on a boat, like that's probably something everybody should know how to do. You know, stuff like that. But after I graduated Corps school, then I had to go to an 8-week training for what they call Field Medical Service School, which is where you learn all your infantry stuff.
Gotcha. So you did your 9 weeks basic training, and then you moved on across to the hospital, and you did your training over there. And then when you came out of there, that was all your medical training, was it?
In the hospital. Yeah, so that involved like the hospital medical training. And then Field Medical Service School was like infantry meets field medicine. Mm-hmm. So you'd learn like some... Like it's just a little different, right? Triage is backwards, you know, things like that.
Battle casualty drills, battlefield first aid. I mean, sticking tourniquets on, whacking drips in, and getting guys back as quick as humanly possible to save lives.
Shooters on a line.
Yeah,
that's it.
So, what happened at the end of that combat training? Where did you go?
Well, I graduated that class, I think in June. And I was, my friend Parker, who I lived with at the time, because I didn't want to live in a barracks, and he was kind enough to invite me into his home life. I still talk to him today too, actually. But he was the first to deploy to Iraq as a combat replacement from our class. And I was the second. I was 3 days behind him. And I cannot remember the date, but I had only graduated field medical service school like 7 to 10 days. So like super green, didn't know anything about anything, you know, really. I had never even been officially like with a Marine Corps unit. You know what I mean? So it was interesting. And I just went straight out into a combat environment from there.
Whereabouts in Iraq were you?
So I flew into Kuwait, obviously, and then to Al-Asad. And then from Al-Asad, I convoyed out to a place called Heat, spelled H-I-T. It's on the Euphrates. They have most of that stuff along the Euphrates I've been into at some point. Haditha, Hakwaniya, all the way up to the Syrian border, every small town in between there at some point.
So you're patrolling the Euphrates effectively then?
Yeah, so my first unit was 3rd Battalion, 25th Marines, and I didn't know any of these guys. They were a reserve unit out of like Ohio and Pittsburgh. And I forget where they were all from because I didn't know these guys. And they didn't know me, you know. It's kind of weird being a combat replacement. You just kind of show up and you're like, "Hey, I'm your new doc." And they're like, "Yeah, okay." it happens so fast. Yeah. You learn your guys and they learn you and you love them just like anything else. And it was one of, the highest and lowest points in my life for sure. But I spent most of my time with them in the Heat area. Yeah. Like you said, along the Euphrates, doing a lot of, like just peacekeeping, security patrols, look for weapons caches, try to get, muster up intel for, different things. It had some rough days. The place was constantly getting indirect fire, just constant. They hated us, I guess,
Yeah, it's a funny old place. I did a tour in Iraq. I was based out of Basra Airport, but I worked in the south. So I was down in Al-Qusayr, I was up in Alamara, I came all the way up to Asamoah and Nasiriyah and everywhere in between. And I've got no desire to go back. I think that's the way I'd say about Iraq. But I did 3 tours of Afghanistan and actually loved them. Had a fantastic time in Iraq, in Afghanistan. And I'll go back there tomorrow if I could.
Interesting. Yeah, they say it's, I've never been to Afghanistan, but in talking to people, like terrain-wise, war fighting-wise, it's just entirely different from everything I understand.
Yeah,
because Iraq is like you're just chasing ghosts and they don't want a firefight. They just want to take their shots and leave. They just want to, they just really want to disrupt stuff. They don't want to fight. That's for sure.
Unlike the Afghans, they did want to have a fight, especially in the early days.
Well, I mean,
in sort of 2006, I got in a few dust ups, on patrols where we were dropping them like falling targets. But later on in 2008-09, it was turned into an IED war, which really took the fun out of it from that point of view.
Right, that's the thing. It's like the Marine Corps loves to fight, we're great at it. It's super frustrating, and all of Iraq that I've been to, which is all Anbar province, albeit, but you don't really know who's the enemy and who's not ever. It's just a big game of, like you said, IEDs and indirect fire and bad intel every corner, and like it's just really hard to get a good stand-up fight. Yeah. It's just how it was.
But, I mean, that's what soldiering's all about, is adjusting to the environment you're in, adjusting to the tactics that they're using, and adjusting your tactics to best effect to win. And So Iraq then. So how long were you there for on that first tour?
So I did like a back to back kind of deal, because I was when you go out as a combat replacement, they just kind of attach you to whatever. So I did fall under 2nd Regiment, which typically would have been like the gravy train, right? You'd have been stationed at an airbase, just in a Rears hospital. But when you're a combat replacement, they say you're attached to 2nd Regiment just because it's fun.
Yeah.
But you're never going to see 2nd Regiment ever. So when 3rd Battalion, 25th Marines ripped out, I was like, oh man, what happens to me now? You know, I was only with them for like 3 to 5 months. And I went back to Al Asad Air Base, sure enough. And I was like, man, this place has chow, it has showers, it has like, you have rooms. Yes. You know what I mean? And I'm living in a fob stacked up 25 deep, sleeping nut to butt with 80 dudes. And I never complained, you know, I almost kind of miss that some days, you know, because that's where it was at, you know. But, I'm like, well, you got 2-bedroom rooms. You got like, it was crazy. And it's like, I just didn't know what to do with myself. And then, you know, that lasted like 3 days, and they're like, oh, you're going back out. And, so from there, I attached to I think it was 2-1, and we did some operations for, they were trying to get onto the Syrian border. You know, there was a lot of Syrian refugees coming in, trying to fight was the issue. And they were really putting effort into stopping all that. And, you know, in between operationally did a million things, like, you know, escorted some, I'm just absolutely ignorant when it comes to anything to do with the army, but they have like those like big like rocket launchers on a trailer. You know, we escorted some of those on. It was a whole artillery battalion. So we ran their security for a while, and we guarded different ammo supply points or ASPs, awaiting orders or contact, and, you know, they'd set up the comms. And you know, it was just like a lot of waiting in the middle of the desert is really what it felt like. and that ended like 2 or 3 weeks. Went back to Al Asad again, and there again, 2-3 days, went back out. This time, right up on the Syrian border there, in the Al-Qaim area. Al-Qaim's kind of far from the Syrian border, but, you know, for reference point, anybody looking at a map, I guess.
Yeah. So it was in the northwest of Iraq, essentially.
Upper corner there.
Yeah.
And, you know, just combat operations the whole time. And so I guess after a year, I did just come back to Al Asad and then flew home. And because I had this weird contract. Typically you can only Navy corpsmen sign a 5-year contract, so it's 5 years active duty, because the training is so long. But I signed this like weird, like 3-year on 2-year reserve contract. So essentially my 3 years was up on active duty, and I just had reserve time. And, I just got out and went home, you know?
So you transferred across to the reserve section then?
Yes.
And that was it? So did you deploy again?
And that was it.
Or did you sign up for more?
No. Nope. I had immediate issues when I got home that I was just really unaware of. So I don't know that they would have taken me back at the time. I just was not mentally well, to be honest.
Is that due to the amount of action that you saw, or is it just
I think
from your past.
I think it's I think when you have an unstable past and then you get to witness such tragedy and not being somebody who has really ever dealt with grief like that, it was crushing. The amount of grief was crushing. The losses were crushing. The the thinking of what people do to each other, it can get really awful if you spend too much time thinking of it like that. Because ultimately, I do believe people are good, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want to think of the world as so dark, yeah. You know?
So did you have any losses while you were on patrol and stuff like that? Did you see a lot of action where guys were being injured and killed?
So each battalion I served with had like a different set of losses, I would say. You know what I mean? It was like a different thing. So a lot of what I would see in like with 3rd Battalion, 25th Marines was a lot of indirect fire incidents where people would get, shrap or, a lot of Iraqi casualties. And, when you're a corpsman, life is life. You take care of enemy like you would take care of your Marines. That's a little hard on you sometimes, because it feels wrong, but it, it's this weird.
You're looking after the enemy as well as you'd look after your own.
Right. It's hard to.
Which is what the war is about, really. I mean, it's the Geneva Convention that dictates that you look after the enemy as well as you look after your own in all situations. It doesn't matter what they've done. If they're injured, you look after them. And we did that exactly the same when we were out in Afghanistan looking after the Taliban that we captured or injured. So we were looking after them as well as we look after our own. And that's just the nature of the beast,
right? And that's the thing. Like if I know anything about warriors and warrior culture and everything, it is that you pray for your enemy, and that can be taken in a lot of context. Mm-hmm. You can pray out of a respect. You can pray because because I believe that we're hell on earth and we're coming. We can. It's just a humility and I think that is necessary to, be as humane as you are inhumane, because that's just what war is. It's a lot of extremes. Yeah. It's hard. It's just hard,
I know exactly where you're coming from. So from that then, you got back, you transferred across to the reserves. I guess that's like the National Guard, or is it just the reserves from the Navy?
Yeah, it's just the reserves from the Navy. So, you're not doing it like anything. Yeah. Some med record stuff. It's a lot lighter.
So you're kind of still employed. You still turn up to a Navy base, and you sort of just working in a medical center, something like that. Is that? Yeah,
right.
So you're still employed full time. You're just not on active service.
Right, not on active duty, not going, you don't have a necessary chain of command you're seeing every day or anything.
Okay.
Let's see, from there, what did I do? I got home and I remember telling everybody I didn't want a job that involved any kind of responsibility. So like HEMSI is the local ambulance service where I was living in Alabama. And, everybody's like, oh, you get a walk-on job there. And I'm like, yeah, look, I'm not doing it. You know what I mean?
Seen enough to keep you going a lifetime.
Yeah. And I did, I gave it a shot. I really did. And at the time I didn't realize it, of course, but like everything would happen and I would just have panic attacks over it. Not that I was just actively falling apart, because if you put a casualty in front of me today, everything will be fine, right? I will just muscle memory it on through.
Get out of it.
Right.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And you're good. But it's all that in between stuff that you can't like. It's like the when you're responsible for these people's lives, yeah. Right? And so especially the Marine Corps, right? It's like I love these men, like I would love my wife, my children, like they are my whole family. Yeah. They're everything. And being medically responsible for them is, you know, I put this crushing weight on myself that like everybody's got to live. And the thing is, not everybody lives. A lot of times you don't have a choice. Yeah. Like there's nothing in the world you could have done that changes anything. And that feels shitty, yeah. You know?
Absolutely.
But it's the reality. It's, you know, it's just something I never really thought of, I guess, in that profession. And I put so much pressure on myself for success and ultimate success. And it just doesn't work that way. Doesn't matter how hard you try or how much you want it. Sometimes it's just not in the cards. And so I was done with the medical field. I'm like, well, never do any of this again, ever. You know, so I spent some time running from it. And so I just started building houses, to be honest.
Slightly different.
Right. Yeah. How do you shift gears like that? But I was just, like I said, that crushing weight, I could not shake it. And, so I built houses for a while and then I started getting these like maintenance jobs and things like that. And I had some, you know, I had some baggage, some pretty good baggage, somewhere in between there, I'd picked up a second wife. And you know, looking back and I didn't have any business getting married. I was not mentally well. And I really believe that I was on some kind of premise that you're just supposed to get married and have kids. Mm-hmm. And that's the American dream. Right. And I was not really, again, I probably didn't really learn how to connect to people until my 40s.
So did you not recognize in yourself the symptoms that you were suffering?
So the thing is like, even when I remember,
I guess as a combat medic, one of the training that you get is to recognize where somebody's
right.
Not right. And if you don't recognize them in other people, then you're difficult to find it in yourself.
Right. So the thing is you, medical people are always the worst patients ever.
Yeah.
Just unanimously, right? And I did. I really tried to find, so I would loophole it for myself, you know. I would have nightmares like all the time, right? But I'm like, hey, these aren't recurring nightmares. Mm-hmm. And everybody would always ask me that, well, do you have recurring nightmares? No. And it wasn't it wasn't until I went into an inpatient facility and I thought, they're going to let me go from this inpatient facility because they're going to find out that I don't have any kind of issues. But she said, do you have recurring nightmares? And I said, no. She said, do you have reoccurring themed nightmares? And I couldn't dodge her anymore. I said, yes. But you know, it's one of those things, like you just lie to yourself because you don't want to be, especially as like a corpsman, right? Like I am the help. I go to people to help them. I don't have people who help me. You know,
is that not one of the things that you do during your training? That I mean, I was a welfare officer for 8 years in London Central Garrison, and one of the things that we go on is help for the helpers. It's a specific course, and it's the mental health first aid for the helpers. So it's looking after your own mental health before you start piling in on other people.
Right. So that's where I'm at now, right? I'm all on that side of things. But you know, I remember getting out and it, like leaving Iraq specifically, you know, now that you mention it, there's a form that asks you, did you see dead bodies? Did you fire your weapon? Did you? And I knew because I'm on the medical side, I'm like, if you check yes to any one of these, you're getting a psych eval.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to get on some kind of medical hold. So these are all no's and I'm going home. Right. And that is what my thought process was. And it's funny now, you know, I look back and I'm like, man, how much time did I waste or didn't waste, or like, what would have been the harm in having a psyche eval? Or, you know, obviously I had some issue.
Yeah. I mean, we see that all the time. I mean, I did 7 operational tours in the 10 years I was in psychological operations. And every single time I came back, I missed out on the decompression. I missed out on being asked those specific questions, because for some reason or other, as I came back, I was on a medevac flight coming back, so I missed everything on that tour. Because I was an individual mentee on most of the tours, apart from the last 3 tours, we went out as teams. And the team missed that as well, because we short-circuited the system. We didn't come out through Cyprus where we should have done.
Sure.
So I missed all of that. But because I'd done the TRIM training, which is a trauma incident management, I was sort of treating myself from the stuff I'd seen. And consequently, I haven't had those issues that lots and lots of people have, because I've done the care for the carers, I've done the mental health first aid, and I've done the TRIM as a TRIM practitioner and a coordinator. So I've seen that in myself, and it's like worry. I don't worry, because if it's nothing you can do about a problem, there's no point in worrying about it, because you can't do anything. If you can do something about it, then there's no point in worrying, because you can do something about it. And that's where I work from. So I think I've been fairly lucky with the way I am. So, but I've seen it a lot in other people where they haven't been okay. And they've been able to recognise that issue and signpost them and get them on to see somebody at the early stages helps a lot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's like you said. If I would have, I think I had little squeaks for help, right? Mm-hmm. Like my commander was, well, my senior chief was aware that I was having nightmares, right? Because he's the one that put me in with the doc, and they gave me volume to sleep, but everybody kind of skirted around it. You know what I mean? And there again, I feel like that wasn't like medically neglected, right? I feel like they were trying. I feel like at the time they felt like they were helping, right? Hey, we don't want him, you know, diagnosed with this, or we don't want, you know. And it, like you said, the other part that's crazy about it is, it's like, look, I was there with 50 other people. They're fine. So why am I not fine? You know what I mean? So that's why I kept just telling myself, I'm like, hey, you're fine. You know,
well, I think it has been an endemic part of particularly combat forces, you know, frontline soldiers.
Right.
They don't want to be seen as having mental health issues. And that creates a lot more mental health issues further down the line. So the recent years, there's been a lot of it's okay to be not okay. Lots of destigmatizing mental health issues in combat troops. And we've still got a long way to go, obviously. However, it's becoming a lot easier for guys to realise that they're not okay, and to seek that assistance early on, and then because they seek the help early on, it's a lot more treatable than it is if it's left. And I think
it's a lot different from, so for me it's been 17 years. So yeah, a lot has changed. And you know, it's always, it's so easy to always look back and be like, yeah, shoulda, coulda, woulda. You know, navigating from the rear is super easy. But at the time it did, like at the time it just felt bad and I didn't really feel like, I don't know. And I was like a comparer too. It's like, well, I don't know. Some of this stuff happened to these people and like, they're not whining and bitching, you know, what's your issue? And it's, you know, pain doesn't work like that either. You know, everything's subjective and only you see and feel through your eyes. Yeah. So, you know, somebody's worst day might be, you know, some IDF coming in, you know, IDF at one point just didn't even hit my radar because it was just so often it was normal. But that doesn't mean that it's not real for that person, you know? And we just got to stop doing all that. Like, you don't get to judge somebody's pain. You just don't.
Everybody's different. Okay. So let's bring us a bit further forward then. So when did you realize that you needed help and what was a catalyst for you, A, seeking help, and B, going into a facility? I guess it was a VA, was it?
Well, no, I never really got much help from the VA, to be completely honest. I just don't think they were equipped at that time, and I don't think I personally was equipped. So I'll take as much fault as I give in that, you know, because you can only help somebody who's willing to really help accept help. And I don't know that I was. So I had little things, right? People would make little comments like, you know, that it just felt distant or detached, which I was, obviously. I would sleep in boots for like, I think a couple of years I slept in boots because I was just so used to being on QRF. I was having the nightmares and the night sweats. I just, you know, was just having this super hard time with like everything. Mm.
How far down the road was this from when you came out?
It was pretty much immediate. Within the first 2 to 3 months, it had really like escalated. Mm. And like the thing is, the further you stuff that stuff, man, you just create a lot of back pressure and it just blows up eventually. But even in Al-Asad in country, like I had already had some issues, right? And I would have, I remember one time, and I'll never forget it because it was wild. I was just sitting on the front steps of my house it was like a container, whatever they had in Al-Asad. It was a nice little house. But it was, I was just sitting out there and I was just gone. I was on some other planet. Mm. You know, I had a really bad 1,000-yard stare and this guy walked past me twice. He says, and he couldn't get my attention. And he asked me, he's like, "Doc, are you okay?" And I'm like, "Oh yeah, I'm good." He's like, "I walked past you twice and asked you if you're okay. You didn't even move." And you know, cause I was, and I thought about it afterwards. I'm like, if that guy was talking to me, what was I doing and where was I at? You know, cause I was just gone. I had some issue like immediately, you know, and then it was like, just kind of escalated out from there. Just got worse and worse. The more I neglected it, the worse it got, you know. But that, you know, and then I had the anger. I was just mad about everything all the time. For lack of a better explanation, I was the most patient man on earth. You could put the most irritating things, you know what I mean? I was just an unbothered person. Nothing bothered me. And now all of a sudden everything bothered me. Anything that was loud, anything that was crowded, anything that felt like there was like some kind of imminent danger in it. I just felt so uncomfortable with just every little thing. Like going to the grocery store was awful. Mm-hmm. So I started combat shopping. You know, it's like, well, I'll just shop at 3 a.m. Ain't nobody gonna be there. Just little things like that. It's just all over the place, you know. And there again, navigating from, you know, the back, it's super easy to see. Somewhere along that ways, I had never drank alcohol. I was 24 at the time I took my first drink ever. And I found that alcohol really soothed my social situations, like grocery shopping. I found that it was like, oh, I can actually sleep. Even though that you know, alcohol sleep is the worst sleep ever. But when you're not getting any quality sleep anyway, it feels better than what you were getting. And it just kind of started like that. But then the booze use really I was just dependent on it for everything. It was like, oh, I have to talk to my mom, you know, because we don't get along. So that stresses me out. So I have to drink all this beer. Oh, the bills are due. Got to drink beer. Got to go to a family event. Got to drink. It was everything. Got to go to work. Got to drink beer. And I spent a good 10 years as a drunk, just straight up drunk.
Doesn't take long to get into it, and then you just become a functioning alcoholic.
Right, and that's why it did take 10 years, you know, because I try to express that to people. It's like, yeah, I was a drunk, but it wasn't like I was a bum. I held a job. I had two kids. I had a wife. It's not like I paid bills. I was drinking and passing out three times a day, but I guess technically held it together to some degree, because, you know, as long as you're not in foreclosure and you're not living in the street, nobody really notices, I guess, as much.
Well, the British Army are famous for it, especially back in my day when I joined the British Army back in 1974, when it was a drinking culture. We'd be on a beer all night and then out at 6 o'clock in the morning and run 10 miles. No problem at all. Functioning alcoholics. Nowadays, it's frowned upon, but back then it was a culture. It's quite easy to get into that habit.
Yeah, military and booze are a hand-in-hand thing. It's always been that way. Especially the Navy's got, you know, some hard traditions like that.
Going into this facility.
So I had finally hit a point to where like very rock bottom, like all the way out. And I could not see a way out of my situation. I had so many emotional roller coasters with booze. Like I wanted to quit and I just could not quit. There was no quitting for me. It was the only cure for the hangover. It was the only way I could sleep. It was the only, you know, every addict excuse that you could throw. And, on July 29th, I stopped drinking and I put all my efforts into that. Like, you know, I'm like, I'm not going back to work. I'm going to get some inpatient facility. You know how insurance and healthcare here is not necessarily top notch, and we're not really equipped for a lot of things. I couldn't find a facility that would take me and take my insurance. And I had no idea that, you know, if you go to a dual diagnosis clinic, it's $20,000 to $50,000. I'm a single income. I have a father of two kids, make $30,000 a year. How am I gonna, you know what I mean? I don't have that kind of money. And I even at the VA, they're like, well, it takes 6 months. And at this point, I am on my last leg. I'm like, I don't got 6 months. I don't got 20 minutes. I need something now. We had like an army, you know. It's like my wife at the time, my sister, my mom, everybody just calling all these places inpatient. I even went to the free clinic, the Betty Floyd clinic, I think it was. And they wouldn't take me because they said the PTSD was too bad. So even like the free state run clinics, I wasn't able to get into, and we'd call places and they'd be like, Well, you have to detox or you could die. And I remember thinking, I don't give a shit. I hope I die at this point. I'm over it all. You know, my ex-wife found this place called Warrior's Heart, and it wasn't like open. It was just opened. They didn't take insurance at all. They only treated veterans and first responders, which made me feel like, you know, way more comfortable immediately. I felt, for whatever it was inside me, I felt like a lot of my story wouldn't be understood necessarily outside of those kind of communities. And you know, I could meet a Marine on the street and talk pretty openly with them. So I felt like that was going to be imperative to getting what I needed to heal. So I set everything up, you know, and they're like, do you have insurance? Yeah. And they're like, well, we don't take insurance. And it was like this whole back and forth thing. And, you know, they told me at the time, they're like, we have a program to where people can be scholarshiped or gifted into the program. But, you know, we only do that like once a year, and it's like one recipient, and, you know, it's based on funds for the year. You know, there was all these like things. And I held that hope. I'm like, God, I hope I can go to that place. But they never said no, and they never said yes. And for every other place that had said no, just not being told no gave me a lot of hope. And I stayed sober. I went on a diet of like Star Mint hard candies and coffee for like weeks, and I felt like total hell all the time. And it's tough to sober up on your own. And I didn't have any kind of capacity to do anything. I wasn't interacting with my family at all. I just felt like I just had to focus on the very next minute and the very next minute. And you know what I mean? It was just don't drink. I got a call back from Warrior's Heart saying that I could go, and that they had found the funding for me, and they wanted to have the person that raised the money for me call me and tell me. And his name's Scott Kaufman. He's a great friend of mine. I still speak with him. He called me, and I remember just crying, just bawling, because I had asked so many people for help and I couldn't get it. And it's frustrating, you know? It's like, I've never asked for anything, and I just want help. You know, it was like a lot of victim mentality, and it, you know, in the end it did work out, but, it was the craziest thing. It's a miracle. It's how it felt, you know? And it's like, I've seen plenty of miracles, but this was just something different for me. And, the relief I had to know that I was going to go get help was incredible. And, you know, of course I thanked him. And they're like, okay, you got to drive out here and meet us tonight. And it was August 15th when they told me that. And so I had stopped drinking, which had, you know, kind of helped with the anxiety and stuff. But now I was just raw, right? So I'm sober and I still have all these problems. Mm-hmm. So the thought of driving out there, I just had a panic attack. I'm like, I can't drive to Texas. I'm in Alabama. I can't make that drive. And so I call him back and I'm like, hey, look, I want to go and I'm going to go. And I know this sounds just absolutely nuts, but like I can only drive at night, and I can all, you know, I need to sleep some through the day so that I can make the drive tonight and, you know, try to be responsible with it. And they're like, yeah, we really need you out here. And I know why they do that, because it's too easy for guys to relapse. You know what I mean? It's like, you gotta get in the door now. And I understand that now, but I was like, I just can't. And so I didn't show up till August 17th. But I did drive that night, and I didn't look at a map or anything. I didn't realize like Texas is huge, just super huge. So I drove all night, and I stopped in the morning. I got a motel, just me and my service dog Dozer. And yeah, I had just hit Texas. So in my mind, I'm like, well, I've done half the drive at least. And then that next day driving through Texas, it was like, oh my God, I'm never going to get there. And you have to hit San Antonio, Austin, Dallas. You hit every city going down to Bandera. So it just felt like I was never going to get there. But I did August 17th. I checked in. They said I was super scary and not very personable, which is all true. When you're raw like that, it's rough. It's super rough. The actual owner was the first person I had talked to face to face in Warrior's Heart, and you know, I'm still a good friend of mine still today. See him and his wife. But he said, man, when we first got you, he said, I didn't think we were going to be able to help you. He said, you were like, you're just still so far gone, you know? And I do remember that. I do remember how I was. I went through like a rebirth of everything. And it's taken years for me to get there, you know? Hard ass work in years, but checking in there was the best thing I ever did.
How long were you in there for?
So I spent 42 days or 45 days in an inpatient environment, and I had so much pent up stuff that I'd never talked about or opened up about. You know, even as far back as like childhood to present day, you know, that's what they want to know. They want to know it all. So wherever your issues are, they're going to touch them, and get you through it. And, after that 42 days, you know, I had 10 years of alcohol abuse and I was in a toxic marriage. It was toxic for her. It was toxic for me, you know, so we were divorcing. We had kind of discussed it anyway. But I knew I couldn't go back home, right? Because it was just too toxic and I was too unstable. And I didn't want to uproot her and my children. I didn't want, you know what I mean? I was fine paying the bills and letting them be. You know, she, love her or hate her, she's still the mother of my children. We still got to parent and raise these two kids. You know, we didn't necessarily have bad blood between us. It was just the right thing to do, you know, split. Yeah. So I asked Josh there again. I said, hey, I know it's not your problem in any way, but, I'm essentially homeless at this point and I don't have anywhere to go. And I don't have any money, but I know that in the past Warrior's Heart has offered some kind of like sober living environments. Do you think there's some way that we can do that? Right. And I'm trying to like bargain with him. I'm like, hey, I'll get an income tax return. You can have that. I'll sign whatever paperwork on credit that you need me to, like I will work day in and day out to pay for this. Something, you know what I mean? Just give me a shot. And, he said, I don't know what we're going to do, but we'll figure it out. And so I was in sober living. So I was on my own. I could leave the facility. I could get a job. I could do, you know, I could live a normal life. I just had to check in. I had to be maintaining VA appointments. You know, just stuff that you do is self-care when you get out of an inpatient facility. And in the time I was working with the canines down, it's an on-site place at Warrior's Heart. So, I worked with the dog trainer they had contracted at that time. I learned about dog training. I already had a service dog who I was able to further in his training vastly. And I you know, that was one of those things. I loved to learn and I loved those dogs. It was a real niche for me. And I got all the way through the dogs that when that contract ended, Josh had called me back and asked me to do his startup for his canine program, which I did. I came back and gave him, became the canine instructor for 6 months is what I gave him.
So what are you doing now?
Well, now I am just I'm retired. I do everything on a voluntary basis. I volunteer for a lot of search and rescue stuff with canines. I'm a chairman of the board of the Warrior's Heart Foundation, which we take cases like mine, similar to mine, where people don't have money or resources to get help. And we review those cases, and myself and Teddy Lanier and Pat Murford review those cases and approve or deny them based on finances, or give them a number, you know, financially copacetic, and get them help, get them treated, you know, so that they don't have that problem of resources like I did. And we give away, you know, over $500,000 a year to veterans and first responders in need.
So it's a bit of a charity.
Yeah. It's a 501, wearsheartfoundation.org. And that's, you know, where I spend a lot of my time. I still do a lot of stuff with Warrior's Heart. For this Memorial Day, we'll be doing the Carry the Load event in Dallas. I do the annual, what they call Rise and Ride, which is run by Scott Kaufman, where they raise money that goes back into the foundation that puts, you know, typically one or two warrior class through the program, raise money for that. 'Cause that's big to me. I was the first annual recipient of that. So that's a big thing for me to be still engrossed in all that. You know, I have 6 children now between my wife and myself. So I do a lot of full-time dad stuff. But I'm big into community and volunteering. You know, that stuff is, like I said, I've always been a humanitarian in that sense. And that stuff is important to me, and it's stuff I still continue to do.
So that's just giving back to the community.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, Doc, that has been an amazing story. And keep up the great work.
I appreciate it.
No, I appreciate you coming on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and look forward to the next one. Welcome to the Tim Hill Podcast. If you have the time, you can not only listen to the episodes, but you can also watch all the shows, and you'll find the links in the description below. Thank you.